Face the Nation, coming up next.
TrueCar.com is changing car buying forever. Yes, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free guaranteed savings. Some features not available in all states. In the first 3 months of this year, over 126,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. TrueCar users save an average of $3,078 off MSRP. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com and find out what other people paid for the car you're looking for. Then, register at TrueCar.com to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step is simple. Just print out your TrueCar savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free car buying experience. Remember, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. Save time, save money, and never overpay. Visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com.
I'm Bob Schieffer, and today on Face the Nation, the ceasefire in Gaza is over. There is intense fighting in eastern Ukraine, and all American diplomats are safely out of Libya. We'll hear this morning from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Pavlo Klimkin, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, plus an excerpt of Charlie Rose's interview with Hamas leader Khaled Mishaal in Doha. And we begin Battleground Tracker, a joint project with the New York Times to gauge the political mood in America and what to expect in the midterm elections. 60 years of news, because this is Face the Nation. Good morning again. We start today in the Middle East, where hostilities have resumed after the temporary humanitarian ceasefire. Barry Peterson joins us this morning from Gaza City. Barry.
Good morning, Bob. Well, all this talk about maybe another ceasefire or an extension, both sides can't seem to quite get it together. I will tell you personally, don't take it to the bank. We had an incident near where we are staying. The Israelis laid down white smoke. That's their way of sending a warning. Several minutes later, they hit the neighborhood hard. We know this area because we've seen some Hamas rockets being fired into Israel. So, yes, it's a legitimate target, also a civilian area. I will say that when there is a ceasefire, Gaza springs back to life. The main market, which was basically abandoned during the shelling, was full of people selling produce and fruit. My favorite moment, coming across the kids in a playground. They had flocked into this playground, filled the area. It was lovely to hear the laughter of children, because what we get most of the time around here is the boom of artillery. Bob?
Barry Peterson. Thank you so much, Barry. And joining us now from Jerusalem, the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. Prime Minister, thank you so much. We hear first that a ceasefire is turned down, then another one is called for, and now apparently that one's off too. What's the very latest?
Look, Israel has accepted, Bob, five ceasefires up to now. We accepted them and we implemented them. Hamas has rejected every single one of them and violated every single one of them, including two humanitarian ceasefires, which we accepted and implemented in the last 24 hours. Now they floated a ceasefire proposal, and you know what? This is quite astounding, Bob. They violated their own ceasefire, and they're firing at us as we speak. So Israel is not obliged and will not let a terrorist organization, a ruthless terror organization committed to our destruction, to decide when, and it's convenient for them to stop for a moment, rearm, and continuing firing on our citizens and our people. We'll determine what is important for our own security in the way that we can to protect our people, including working against these terror tunnels that they're digging against us. That's how we'll act. We'll just act to protect our people.
So will you increase the ground offensive inside the Gaza, or what is the next step here, Prime Minister?
I'm not going to talk about military operations. I will say we have a right to defend ourselves. You have to just imagine the United States having 80% of its population under rocket fire and 80% of your people having to go to a bomb shelter every within 60 or 90 seconds. That's unsustainable. We've imagined the United States having terror tunnels dug underneath your border in order to come in and explode your kindergartens or murder and kidnap your citizens. Imagine attacks by land, by sea, and by air. Obviously, you take whatever action is necessary to protect your people, and that's essentially what Israel is doing. I can't go into more information than that. I hope we achieve a sustainable quiet that will enable us to address the issue of demilitarizing Gaza, because I think that's the real issue. How do we demilitarize Gaza? And if Hamas is weakened, discredited, and demilitarized, then we may have a chance to work something with the more moderate forces and get a better future for all of us.
Prime Minister, I know you have been concerned about these tunnels for a long time, and if you'd known they were up to something there, but was this underground complex more extensive than even you had thought it was?
Well, we knew about the terror tunnels, more or less the size of it. We're obviously getting more information now, precise information, but what you see is this vast underground terror kingdom, these vast tunnels in which they poured in tens of thousands of tons of concrete. You know, people were saying, bring concrete to Gaza, bring cement to Gaza to help build Gaza. And what Hamas did was take all that cement, all that concrete, and poured it into the tunnels that are meant to come in under our communities and blow up our kids and kidnap our people. I think that the economic and social relief that people want to have for Gaza and that we want to have for the people of Gaza once this is over is tied to demilitarization. We'd have to, as this example shows, make sure that concrete that is brought in is not abused and brought to dig in new tunnels. We'd have to make sure that money that people want to go for the people of Gaza for their social relief, and we have no objection to that, is not used for buying rockets and missiles and drones and everything else that Hamas is using against us. I think that what we need is demilitarization of Gaza and alongside economic and social relief for the people of Gaza. But the economic and social relief for the people of Gaza, I think, is tied to demilitarization.
Prime Minister, when you say demilitarization, what exactly does that mean? Does that mean Israeli troops go back in there and keep the peace? Obviously, you're talking about shutting down these tunnels, but what does that really mean?
I think that has to be discussed as part of the overriding goal, because otherwise we could find ourselves in the same situation. I think once we get the Egyptian initiative, which basically calls for an unconditional effort to try to address these problems, I think that once we get into that, we'll have to discuss the means of actually making sure that Gaza is not remilitarized. How do we prevent stuff from coming in? What do we tie in vis-a-vis social and economic relief? How do we make sure that money or materials that go in are not used for remilitarizing Gaza? There are ways of doing this. I think it's important to put that out as an overriding goal, and it'll have to be discussed in Egypt when the time comes.
Prime Minister, let me ask you this. Many people agree with and sympathize with your determination to stop these attacks on your people. That is very understandable. But they're also worried that every time the world sees these pictures of these children being hurt and killed, that you may be losing the battle for world opinion. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think this gets to the essence of Hamas's strategy. Hamas is responsible for these civilian deaths. Hamas is not only trying to kill our people, it's sacrificing its own people quite willfully, deliberately, cynically, and horribly. They are using their people as human shields. You know, we asked the people to leave, the civilians to leave. They asked them to stay. Why are they asking them to stay? Because they want the bodies of Palestinian civilians to pile up. And every time we see a dead civilian, you know, we regret it deeply. I mean, nobody can fail to have the feelings of regret and sorrow when you see these things. But the blame should be placed where it belongs, at Hamas's door, because Hamas actually wants to have more and more Palestinian civilians killed, and that's why they're using them as human shields. I think that should be condemned. I recognize what you say about world opinion, but I can only appeal to decent people everywhere and tell them, if you're concerned about civilian lives, it's not because of Israel. Israel is not targeting a single civilian. It's Hamas that wants to have Palestinian civilians killed. And it's Hamas that should be squarely blamed.
Prime Minister, thank you so much for taking time to tell the American people the very latest on this. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
CBS News this morning, co-host Charlie Rose sat down yesterday in Doha, Qatar, with the leader of Hamas, Khalid Mashal. He went directly to the question, what does Hamas want?
The war in Gaza sends two messages, Mr. Charles, to the world. The first message, it is high time to lift the siege on Gaza. Gaza wants to live as other people.
That is exactly what Secretary Kerry has asked to be negotiated after the ceasefire, to have a week of ceasefire, so that you could do that. But you're asking that to be done as a precondition to the negotiations.
This is not a prerequisite. Life is not a prerequisite. Life is a right for our people in Palestine. Since 2006, when the world refused the outcomes of the elections, our people actually lived under the siege of 8 years. This is a collective punishment. We need to lift the siege. We have to have a port. We have to have an airport. This is the first message. The second message, in order to stop the bloodletting, we need to look at the underlying causes. We need to look at the occupation. We need to stop the occupation. Netanyahu doesn't take heed of our rights. Mr. Kerry, months ago, tried to find a window through the negotiations in order to meet our target, to live without occupation, to reach our state. Netanyahu has killed our hope, has killed our dream, and he killed the American initiative. We are not fanatics. We are not fundamentalists. We do not fight the Jews because they are Jews per se. We do not fight any other races. We fight the occupiers. On the contrary, we actually respect the religious people. We ask for tolerance, for coexistence between the Buddhists, the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims. As you know, God created us as nations. We are different. The Quran says that in order for the nations to live together and coexist together without occupation and without any blockade.
I think I just heard you say, and this will close on this, you believe in the coexistence of peoples, and therefore you believe in the coexistence of Palestinians and Israelis in the Middle East.
I cannot coexist with occupation.
But without occupation, you can coexist.
I'm ready to coexist with the Jews, with the Christians, and with the Arabs and non-Arabs, and with those who agree with my ideas and those who disagree with them. However, I do not coexist with the occupiers, with the settlers, and
It's one thing to say you want to coexist with the Jews. It's another thing you want to coexist with the state of Israel. Do you want to coexist with the state of Israel? Do you want to represent? Do you want to recognize Israel as a Jewish state?
No. I said I do not want to live with a state of occupiers. I do coexist with other religions.
I'm assuming they're no longer occupiers. At that point, do you want to coexist and recognize their right to exist as they would recognize your right to exist?
When we have a Palestinian state, then the Palestinian state will decide on its policies. You cannot actually ask me about the future. I answered you, but Palestinian people can have their say when they have their own state without occupation. In natural situations, they can decide the policies vis-a-vis others.
Thank you.
Welcome.
So, more of Charlie's interview tomorrow morning on CBS This Morning and the entire one-hour interview tomorrow night on the Charlie Rose Show on PBS. We want to turn now to the other major story this morning, the battle in Ukraine, where government forces have begun a new battle against Russian-backed separatist rebels backed by Moscow for the key city of Donetsk in the country's eastern region. And joining us to give us the latest on that is Ukraine's Foreign Minister, Pavlo Klimkin. Foreign Minister, thank you so much. So let me just ask you now, your forces are trying to take back Donetsk. Do you have the military wherewithal to do that?
Good morning. And my first point, and very clear point, we are the people of peace. We are for the peaceful settlement, and we are quite confident that we could negotiate a peaceful settlement with everyone, with the people of Donbas. But we can't negotiate directly, of course, with the terrorists who shut down the plane, who have been killing people, taking hostages, taking even the small pensions from the old and vulnerable people. It's exactly the point. And the main leaders of the terrorists, they're Russian citizens with different connections with Russian special services. And our message is quite clear. We need the bilateral ceasefire. We don't need military offensive. We need bilateral ceasefire. We need, of course, clear control of the border, because everything is coming to Ukraine across the border, not just mercenaries and money, but, of course, the weapons and heavy weaponry. And, of course, we need a clear idea how to reach the peaceful settlement. And we have a peace plan for that.
Well, let me ask you this. What do you think President Putin is up to here? What is he trying to do?
You know, if you see the Donetsk in Donbas, it's our land. And who does need Donbas with all the heavy industries there? It's about a clear attempt of destabilizing the eastern Ukraine. It's about disrupting any kind of critical infrastructure. If you are even theoretically a separatist, you would like more independence, and you would like to live on your own land. But why there to destroy all kind of infrastructure, electricity networks, water and gas pipelines? So it's about a clear idea how to destabilize the eastern Ukraine, and through the eastern Ukraine, probably the whole Ukraine.
It's not just
about eastern Ukraine and Ukraine. It's my point.
What would you like to see the United States do right now?
We see the United States as a friend and partner, and we have also solidarity from the United States. What we need now is to make Ukraine a success. We are fully committed to freedom. We are fully committed to the rule of law. It's a difficult financial situation in Ukraine, also because of ongoing developments in the eastern Ukraine. So we need U.S. assistance for successful economic reforms, for the reforms in the sphere of rule of law. But we also need more assistance on the ground, also for our forces. So it's a kind of package we need to make Ukraine successful, to make Ukraine united, democratic, and European country.
Is it there any doubt in your mind that the Russians are responsible for the shooting down of that airliner?
Imagine you can buy a rifle, a Kalashnikov, on a black market. But how can you buy on a black market highly sophisticated anti-air missile capable to shoot down the planes at the altitude of 10,000 meters? And if then, you know, can you imagine that the terrorists could operate highly sophisticated weapons there? So it's, of course, about responsibility of those who bring also across the border all inflow of weapons and weaponry. And it has to stop. And it's one of the preconditions for successful and peaceful settlement in the eastern Ukraine.
Mr. Prime Minister, thank you for joining us, and we wish you the very best.
We'll be
back in a minute.
TrueCar.com is changing car buying forever. Yes, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free guaranteed savings. Some features not available in all states. In the first 3 months of this year, over 126,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. TrueCar users save an average of $3,078 off MSRP. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com and find out what other people paid for the car you're looking for. Then, register at TrueCar.com to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step is simple. Just print out your TrueCar savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free car buying experience. Remember, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. Save time, save money, and never overpay. Visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com.
Well, joining us now to tell us what he knows about all of this, one of the most knowledgeable members of the House of Representatives, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers. Let's just go back to Israel for a minute. Hamas continues to fire these rockets. They've poured all this concrete, as you heard Prime Minister Netanyahu talk about. Where are they getting this stuff?
You know, it's an interesting combination, and there's an interesting development on this front. So Iran is publicly in their own newspapers touting the fact that they're helping militarize Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And now the Qataris are saying, hey, we want to pull Iran away from that, and we want to support, which is a dangerous combination for Israel. So you have this two-front combination. The Qataris are certainly engaged. We believe that some of this money is coming from Saudi Arabia, not the official government, but from other sources. And so that money, and they pilfer money that is coming in from legitimate purposes to divert to tunnels. So if you think about how obscene that is, the hundreds of millions of dollars they've had over a decade, 20% of the people in Gaza Strip aren't connected to a water source. 90% of all the water there doesn't meet international standards. But they've got, I think the Israelis just closed 35 tunnels. So they're diverting legitimate money, and you have Iran that is maligned into this particular interest in a way that's very, very dangerous.
But I thought the Qataris were our allies here.
Well, this is what makes this region so interesting. So you have Iran, and the Qataris are certainly supporting Hamas. And certainly factions thereof. They're also supporting places in Syria. So that's why this is so intertwined in a way that makes it a very dangerous stew indeed. It is one common thing that the Shias and the Sunnis don't like, and that's a Jewish Israel state. That is confirmed. And I think they've found an outlet to try to do this. And it's spreading to other areas, Bob. This is what's the other problem. There is the unseen war in this particular event, and that's the new cyber front. There are not only what you see coming from Hamas attacks on Israel, but now we have nation states engaged in the region in cyber conflict that could cause this to escalate in a way that's very, very dangerous for stability.
How much do you think they have? How much money do you think has been poured into these tunnels? It's literally millions of dollars, which, as I understand it, came in there to build schools.
And again, I think they diverted some of the legitimate money. Clearly that happened. So instead of building wells or water infrastructure, they diverted that money to build these tunnels. And I think that they're getting money, again, from Iran, who has been a malign force in that whole entire region. Think about it. They're supporting Hezbollah in the fight in Syria and supplying Hamas in the Gaza Strip with weapons. That is the difficult part here. And what's concerning about that is just about 10 days ago or so, the United States agreed to allow Iran to have another $2.8 billion released just for them to continue nuclear negotiations. And that's what's so frustrating with the administration. Now, all of this works together. You can't just pick and choose one particular region. It has to work in concert. So when you free up $2.8 billion for Iran, when they're already cash strapped because of sanctions, that means they can continue to do bad activities in the Gaza Strip, including missile, we believe, at least missile components. We understand, according to public reports, they've even offered to help hide those missile systems and their work in Syria with supporting the Assad regime. It's not working in concert that is helping us cause this confusion around the Middle East.
Well, Congressman, I want to take you explained and made this thing even more dire than I understood it at the beginning of this broadcast. I want to thank you very much for coming by and filling us in.
Thanks, Bob.
Always good. I'll be back with some personal thoughts in just a moment. Trying to understand the news of this terrible summer, it is hard to come away with any feeling but that we are in the midst of a world gone mad. On one side of the world, an ego-driven Russian leader seems to yearn for the time of the czars, when rulers started wars on a whim or a perceived insult, and if people died, so be it. In the Middle East, the Palestinian people find themselves in the grip of a terrorist group that has embarked on a strategy to get its own children killed in order to build sympathy for its cause, a strategy that might actually be working, at least in some quarters. Last week, I found a quote of many years ago by Golda Meir, one of Israel's early leaders, which might have been said yesterday. "We can forgive the Arabs for killing our children," she said, "but we can never forgive them for forcing us to kill their children." In a world gone mad, what is to be learned? Perhaps we should start by remembering what historian Will Durant once said. Barbarism, like the jungle, does not die out, but only retreats behind the barriers that civilization has thrown up against it, and waits there always to reclaim that to which civilization has temporarily laid claim. Back in a minute.
TrueCar.com is changing car buying forever. Yes, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free guaranteed savings. Some features not available in all states. In the first 3 months of this year, over 126,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. TrueCar users save an average of $3,078 off MSRP. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com and find out what other people paid for the car you're looking for. Then, register at TrueCar.com to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step is simple. Just print out your TrueCar savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free car buying experience. Remember, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. Save time, save money, and never overpay. Visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com.
Welcome back now to Face the Nation, and we turn now for some perspective on all of this to former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Madam Secretary, we're very happy to have you and to get help us to try to understand. Have you ever, I mean, I can remember times when the nation I thought was coming apart, 1968 in the battle over Vietnam and all of that, the 68 Democratic Convention. But can you recall a time when there was so much trouble in so many different places around the world?
Well, first of all, it's good to be with you, Bob. But I think that the fact that this is happening in so many different parts of the world, we all grew up in a very different era where we were focused on the threat from the Soviet Union, and that was the major activity. And it clearly was dangerous. But what has happened now is that we are seeing problems in a variety of places, some of it due to globalization, frankly, which has a opposite side that has created a lot of nationalism in those countries that or places where people feel lost within kind of the facelessness of globalization, and then because of technology, because there is so much connectivity, but also not an understanding of all the various pieces of the news that come into us.
But, you know, I mean, we have so much going on right now. It's almost like we're caught up in events out of control that we haven't until this second, when I'm going to bring it up, had time to even talk about the shutting down of the U.S. Embassy in Tripoli, Libya, because these Americans there were caught in the middle of basically a fight among militias. I'm happy to report that they all got safely out. Secretary of State says that's just temporary, but almost no attention to that. We haven't talked very much in the last week or so about what's going on in Syria, of all places, and that is just a slaughterhouse, apparently.
Well, there are two really different things going on, and I think partially, Bob, in diplomatic world, there's something going on all the time, and it is the job of diplomats to manage it. But there have been really two huge game changers. And one is Putin's behavior vis-a-vis first Crimea and then now towards Ukraine, and a completely different kind of behavior by Russia. And the other is what is happening in the Middle East, a lot of it due to the Arab awakening and also the artificiality of the borders that were established after World War I. So these are huge game changers. And we are, a lot of Americans, trying to figure out where the countries are. Most Americans knew very little about Islam. They certainly didn't know a difference between Shia and Sunni. So there are an awful lot of things going on that need understanding and explanation. But to put it mildly, the world is a mess.
What is your take on Putin right now? What do you think he's up to? What does he want? How can we get his attention? Because right now he seems to be thumbing his nose at us, even though we continue to put sanctions on him.
I think that Putin is living in his own world. He has made up an awful lot of lies in terms of who is responsible for the fact that the Soviet Union disintegrated. He actually called that the greatest disaster of the 20th century. Hard to believe when there were two world wars that killed millions of people, among them Russians. So that's the first lie. And then he has, in fact, propagandized all that through his own country and then into Central and Eastern Europe. I think what he wants to do is to reestablish himself as the identification of Russian nationalism, and then also to do everything he can to kind of reestablish something akin to the Soviet Union, obviously not that, but a grouping of countries around Russia that are completely subservient to him and to Moscow. And until he can get that, he's going to work to destabilize Eastern Europe.
Talk a little bit about what's going on in Israel right now. If you were the Secretary of State right now, what would you be telling the president? What can the United States do here?
Well, let me say, I so admire Secretary Kerry for all the effort he's put into this. I think all of us as secretaries had worked very hard on it, but it is a tough proposition. We actually know what the solution is. President Clinton laid that out before he left, and a two-state solution and a number of other aspects to it. The United States can put down all kinds of plans, but until there is political will between the parties themselves, it's very hard to have anything happen. But I think Secretary Kerry is doing everything he can at this moment to kind of prolong the short peaceful ceasefires or humanitarian ceasefires, and then see whether he can get them back to the table. But the problem, as we heard in the Charlie Rose interview, is what are the preconditions for even getting to discussing the conditions? So it's a tough sell for everybody.
But, you know, listening to the Hamas leader talking to Charlie Rose, and he said, yes, we can coexist with the Jews. But he said, we can't coexist with the Jewish state. And Charlie said, well, but how do you go from? Well, he said, we'll decide after we get our state whether we can coexist with the Jewish state. It sounds to me like these two sides are as far apart as they have ever been.
I think they are. I think and certainly that sounded like a double talk to me. But the bottom line is they are seeing each other's problems from a completely negative side. When what you need to do in diplomacy is at least try to put yourself into the other person's shoes. And they are definitely not doing that. And they are propagandizing. The Hamas is definitely trying to persuade its population that everything is the fault of Israel, which I think is unfair. Israel has a right to protect itself. But I think that they are far apart. They are definitely.
Is Israel in danger? And I talked to the prime minister about that this morning. I totally understand his point of view. In fact, I agree with it. No country would allow another country or another group of people to fire rockets in there. But as these horrible pictures continue to come on television, are they in danger of losing this battle for world opinion because they're winning?
I think the quote that you had from Golda Meir is so stunning. And as you pointed out, it could be said today. And then there was this incredible movie called The Gatekeepers that where a lot of military people had really were so sad about how they had been made to be more cruel as a result of a lot of the things that were going on. I am concerned about Israel. I am a great believer in the security of Israel and the moral authority of the Israelis, but I am very worried about what is going on in terms of their image.
Let me ask you about something else and how things look on television. The president has gotten a lot of criticism lately for going to all these fundraisers. Every time you turn on the TV, he's en route to a fundraiser, even though these horrible things are happening around the world. Is that criticism fair? If you were in the White House now, would you say, Mr. President, maybe you ought to dial back a little bit on that part?
I don't think it's fair. I do know the following thing, that a president does not travel alone. Not only is there a lot of equipment that goes with him that allows him to be in contact, and he has his advisors around him. I also do think that we do not want to operate in a way that the United States kind of decides that there's nothing we can do until, unless, of course, it's foreign policy. And I disagree with that. I do think that the United States has to be engaged. I have believed that. I have called us the indispensable nation, which means that the U.S. has to be at the table. And the president, I know, has been on the phone. He has been working in a number of ways to push. And you can see that in terms of not just the phone calls, but meetings and a variety of ways. So I don't think it's fair.
You know, rightly or wrongly, and I take your point, there is a perception, it seems to me, that in many parts of the world, there is an impression that the United States is somehow stepping back.
I read that myself, but I don't believe it. I think that the thing that has changed is we don't want to be the world's policeman. The American people don't, and I think that what has to happen is to really work harder on the variety of partnerships. When I said indispensable, again, not alone. It requires partners. It requires sometimes being at the table speaking first, sometimes speaking last, motivating others to do the things with us. And in the first part of the program, you talked a lot about Europeans. The president has been pushing the Europeans. The Europeans have to step up. I am appalled, frankly, at the slowness of the Europeans in understanding what is going on in Europe itself, in being not only supportive, but being genuine partners in pushing on what Putin is doing, on supporting Ukraine, on making clear that the kind of behavior that Putin engaged in is illegal, and that we have a responsibility together, and the United States together with our partners, I think, is very much in the lead.
Madeleine Albright, it's always great to get your perspective. Thank you so much for spending this time with us. We'll be right back. Well, we're going to have some analysis now from one of the busiest people at CBS News, and that's our State Department correspondent, Margaret Brennan, who is logging more miles than an airline captain these days. She's just back, got in, what, about 11 or 12 o'clock last night?
Landed a little after midnight with Secretary Kerry last night.
So, Margaret, what is the secretary's mood right now? Where does he think we are on any of this?
Well, the secretary left the Middle East with no firm ceasefire agreement in hand, but the hope that you could see short-term rolling ceasefires that could ultimately end up with both sides stopping from killing each other long enough to agree that maybe it's worth talking. But it's not clear, really, what was agreed, and that's going to be played out on the ground. But what we do see, and what Kerry's message to the Israeli prime minister really was, is that you may be winning the war against Hamas, but more broadly, you're losing the war in Gaza, which is Palestinians are watching fellow Palestinians get killed. You saw massive protests in the West Bank while we were there in the Middle East, that there's outcry around the Arab world, and that vote at the UN was not insignificant. The United States was the only country that stood with Israel and said they don't want to see an inquiry of these accusations of human rights abuses. So for them, for the United States, they're saying, look beyond this immediate conflict. We need to talk and have negotiations about a broader settlement here that addresses some of the real security issues longer term.
And what about Putin? What's the latest news on that? Do we think we're anywhere close to even getting his attention?
Well, it's been costly for him to do what he's doing, but it certainly hasn't stopped him from carrying out and helping to buttress some of those Russian troops they have at the Ukrainian border. The State Department just this morning released some of these images of what they say is proof that Russian artillery has been helping and firing and supplementing some of those separatists cross-border, which is to say this isn't just Russia backing the separatists. This is Russia fighting for the separatists. So it's really not clear. I mean, the strategy doesn't seem to have changed. It's just about sanctions right now. It's about punitive rather than preventative measures, and the Europeans are very slow to react.
And what about the situation in Tripoli, in Libya? We did get the diplomats out of there. Is there anything we don't know about that? Anything, a backstory here?
Well, there's a lot of concern in the region. This is one of the things that Secretary Kerry was talking about in Cairo with Egyptian officials, is they're looking next door to Libya and very concerned about the terror threat emanating from there and that country really being on the brink of civil war. The administration is very sensitive, of course, to the security of diplomats in Libya, particularly after what happened in Benghazi with the attack on the U.S. diplomatic mission there. So while they said there's no direct threat against diplomatic personnel or the embassy, they got the diplomats out because they see these militias fighting very close proximity to the U.S. embassy itself. When they're going back is totally unclear.
All right. Well, we're going to let you go home. You might want to take a nap this afternoon because I know you're going to be on the road again pretty soon.
No doubt.
Thank you very much, Margaret. We'll be back to talk about campaign 2014. We'll take our first look at that. And we are back now to begin a new project with the New York Times that we are calling Battleground Tracker. We'll be working with a group called YouGov. We've assembled an online panel of 100,000 voters who are in every competitive Senate and congressional district. Between now and Election Day, we're going to be in contact with that panel to gauge the mood of the electorate and to estimate what the results would be if the election were held at that point. We're at this point to talk about this morning the project and the results of the first survey. Anthony Salvanto is our CBS News Elections Director. David Leonhardt is the editor of the New York Times Upshot. Rounding out our analysis will be Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report and John Dickerson, our own CBS News political director. So, Anthony, the big question, if the election were held today, based on the data that you all have assembled, the big question is, would the Democrats hold their majority in the Senate?
No, our estimate has the Republicans taking it at least 51-49. And there's a little bit of movement maybe towards 52, 53 in some scenarios there. But Republicans, we find, have this edge because they have so many options, because there are so many states in play now. We always knew that the Democrats would have a hard time holding a lot of these southern states, these conservative states, where there's a lot of Senate races and they're defending more seats. But we see a very expansive map out of this data. We see a lot of races that are very, very tight, too.
So, six seats. The Republicans would have to hold all that they've got and then pick up six seats to claim the majority. Is that right?
That's right. And, you know, we think they have an inside track or even a certainty on at least two or three of them. So they really just need to get a couple more. Now, pushing back against this a little bit, though, is the Democrats would like to try to take Kentucky. They'd like to try to take the Georgia seat. And they think they have good candidates there, but right now in our polling, they're just a little short.
Okay, so David, what are the races? Democrats and the two independents in the Senate hold 55 Senate seats, Republicans 45. What are the races that will have to change that if the Republicans do in fact take control?
The thing to remember is senators run every 6 years. So the people running for election now ran 6 years ago, 2008, a year of a Democratic wave, the Obama wave. And so you've got a lot of these races in Republican-leaning states most of the time, and that's the problem for Democrats here. So it's North Carolina, where Kay Hagan is running a tough reelection campaign. It's Arkansas, with the same with Mark Pryor. It's Alaska. We're talking about a lot of states that in the presidential elections vote Republican. And so essentially, although many things can happen, the Democrats still have a good chance to keep it. The reason we think Republicans are favored are, if each of these states simply go the way it goes in the presidential election, Republicans get Senate control.
Well, I would say at this point it would appear if the election were held today, the Democrats would probably lose Montana.
Yes.
Probably lose South Dakota. Probably lose West Virginia. Good news for the Democrats, if the election were held today, they would probably hold their seats in New Hampshire and Colorado. And Anthony, you're talking about that race in Kentucky, and also the race down in Georgia, where Sam Nunn's daughter, Michelle Nunn, is the Democratic candidate. Talk a little bit about those races, David.
So I think Kentucky is a pretty tough task for the Democrats. I think Mitch McConnell should be considered a pretty strong favorite. A state that is as strongly as Republican as Kentucky, the idea of it flipping to the president's party in a midterm election would be exceedingly unusual from political history. So I think Kentucky's a really tough task for the Democrats. Not impossible, but tough. Georgia is easier, and it's in part because of demographic change. Georgia has a growing Latino population. Black turnout has risen a lot. And so while I think Michelle Nunn is probably a slight underdog, she has a real shot to win that race, which would be very important for the Democrats.
You know, Bob, one of the things we see out of this is that with so many tight races, 1 point, 2 points here and there, yes, our estimates point in one direction at this point. We should think of this as a baseline. We're not trying to make predictions here. We're trying to gauge with this panel where we are today. But it tells me that the local campaigns are really going to matter because 1 or 2 points here can move easily. I mean, we're going to track this, and I suspect we're going to come back here through the fall and see some back and forth, which, you know, should be pretty fun to watch. Anyway.
I want to bring in Amy and John. Amy, well, what is there anything that ties all these races together? Is this going to be any kind of a wave election, as we call it, or are these all individual races?
Well, clearly what we're seeing in these numbers is that if there is a good news here for Republicans, is that the environment is very good for the Republicans, right? The president's overall approval rating pretty low. The enthusiasm on the part of Republicans, much higher to turn out and vote than for Democrats. People aren't feeling very good about the direction of the country. And as we pointed out, so many of these states are red states carried by Mitt Romney. So that all goes to the benefit of Republicans. What's standing in their way, what's standing in Republicans' way, in many cases, are Republicans themselves. We saw them in 2010 and 2012 lose what were supposed to be slam dunk seats because their candidates were terrible. Candidates matter, campaigns matter, and this is where Democrats say the other thing that matters is that Republicans' approval rating's much lower than it was in 2010. This is a very different kind of environment. People have seen Republicans in control of the House, and they don't like what they see. And so that's the one thing that Democrats have. The other thing is that they know how to go and work on the ground. They say, Barack Obama, that campaign, they revolutionized the way we go, target and turnout voters. You're not going to be able to see any of that in polling. The only way you'll be able to see it is actually when we get the election day results.
And so when people in these states, these key Senate states, are watching this election, they're going to have the traditional feeling of disappointment. They're not going to hear people talking about what you've been talking about on the show all day today, the things that are roiling the world. They may not even hear the things that roil us at home. Because Democrats, to push back against this national wave, all these advantages, and I'd add one other, the electorate in an off-year election tends to be older, which tends to benefit Republicans. They get more of that vote. To turn out single women, minorities, younger voters, Democrats, those folks don't turn up in midterm elections. So how are Democrats going to get at them? They're going to target them with specific. There's going to be a lot of talk about women's health because Democrats want to turn out suburban women voters and single women voters. An important issue, but not maybe what's on the top of everybody's mind. There will be a lot of these attempts to narrow cast into those constituencies to increase Democratic turnout in this special election year.
You know, Ronald Reagan got a larger percentage of the white vote than Mitt Romney did. And Ronald Reagan won. Am I right in that?
Romney got a larger percentage of
it didn't sound right as coming out of my mouth. These things happen. He got a larger percentage of the white vote than Ronald Reagan did, yet he lost this election. But you had Barack Obama in this race in 2012. He's not there this time. Will that make a difference?
Well, we have some evidence that it's not just Obama. Obama as a candidate matters, but if you look at some other elections, if you look at some midterm elections, it seems that voter turnout among African Americans has risen in a way that isn't just about Obama. And, of course, we have vastly more Latinos and Asian Americans, two groups that vote heavily Democratic. As John pointed out, many of these groups don't vote as heavily in midterm elections. It will be a big test of the Democratic turnout machine in 2014.
Having said that, we see historically that people who go to the polls and disapprove of the sitting administration when the president's not on the ballot vote 80% or more against his party's congressional candidate. So to that extent, yes, he is on the ballot.
That's right. And in many of these states, these are not heavily minority majority states, you know, where the electorate is going to look different. This is not a battle for control of Pennsylvania or Florida, Colorado being an exception in this race. But these are a lot of southern states or a lot of states where the white vote is still the key to winning these elections.
All right. Well, we have to end it there. Thank you all. We'll be back. We'll see you guys next month when we'll see if the election were held then, what the results would be. For complete results on all of this, check out our CBS News website and the Upshot section on the NewYorkTimes.com. Well, that's it for us today. Be sure to tune in to CBS This Morning tomorrow morning for more of the interview with Hamas leader Khalid Mashal and for all the latest on all of these developments around the world. That's it for us. See you next week right here on Face the Nation.
This has been Face the Nation with CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent Bob Schieffer. Today's guests were Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Hamas leader Khalid Mashal, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Pavlo Klimkin, Congressman Mike Rogers, and former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager, and the senior producer is Rob Hendon. This broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stocky-Wayne from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com. And you can follow Face the Nation, Bob Schieffer, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Google+, and Facebook.